A rested child is a happy child. Sleep Tight Stories is a weekly podcast that brings comfort and joy to families worldwide with calming bedtime stories. The stories are relevant to children and spark wonder without overstimulation, so they can fall asleep and stay asleep. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or a bedtime routine you'll miss when they're grown? Sleep Tight Stories.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nadelman, and this is Psychoactive, a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. Psychoactive is the show where we talk about all things drugs. But any views expressed here do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Protozoa Pictures, or their executives and employees. Indeed, as an inveterate contrarian, I can tell you they may not even represent my own. And nothing contained in this show should be used as medical advice or encouragement to use any type of drug. Hello, Psychoactive listeners. You know, one of the things I love about doing this podcast is that I really get to pick any guest I want who I think is really smart and has interesting things to say. And you may have listened to the episode with Nora Volkow, the longtime head of National Institute on Drug Abuse, or the ones with Dan Ciccheroni, the UCSF professor, expert on overdose, or Andy Weil. And this one is somebody who ranks at the level of brilliance of any of those previous guests, but whose life has been quite a bit different. His name is Leonard Picard, and Leonard Picard is known, if you look him up on Wikipedia or anywhere else, for being, allegedly, I should say, perhaps the world's greatest producer of LSD in the 20th century. And now, Leonard is not just that, of course. I mean, he's a brilliant chemist, helps explain why he allegedly did what he did. But he's also somebody who ended up with a master's degree in the Kennedy School, did really interesting drug research. He's also somebody who was sentenced in the early 2000s to two life sentences in a federal prison and spent something like two decades behind bars in a maximum security prison, and then just got out at the very beginning of this year, 2021, I think in good part because of COVID and a sort of compassionate release, although I think there was also a campaign to try to get him released early as well. And he remains under supervised release, which also will inhibit a bit what he can say about his life and his activities. So I've asked Leonard in talking about this. I'm going to be blunt and asking him every question. He's going to do his best to answer as frankly as he can. But where he'd feel that there might be some risk, he might answer a little more in the abstract. And so you, the audience, should take his comments as maybe or maybe not reflecting his actual real life world experience. Now, Leonard, hello. Thank you so much for joining me on Psychoactive.
Well, hello, Ethan. Lovely to see you again. You know, a year ago, we couldn't have this conversation, so it's particularly meaningful to be able to speak with you after so many years.
I know. I've been wondering about my ability to try to get other people who actually are currently behind bars to be on a podcast, but I'm imagining most prison systems in America, maybe other countries, wouldn't allow that. Now, you know, you and I, we first crossed paths very briefly in the mid-90s, I think it was, at some psychedelics conference in the Bay Area, and then had no contact thereafter for, you know, really since you got out. And then one of my fellow producers said, hey, how about this fellow Leonard Picard? And so you and I have now had a chance to spend some time together, both in New York and in Boulder, Colorado. You've introduced me to some of your friends and contacts in the psychedelics investment space. But I wanted to start off really by just asking you this. When we talk about your reputation as being the biggest or one of the biggest producers of LSD in global history, can you say, well, yep, that's true? Or are you in a position where it's really hard to, you know, own that at this point, or whether maybe it's actually factually not true?
My goodness. First of all, I should preface this for your audience that Ethan and I had quite a rollicking conversation until midnight some weeks ago in Boulder, Colorado, and which we went over quite a few things that perhaps can't be talked about on this podcast. But I do remain under federal supervision, and I must maintain my position under oath at federal trial that the allegations are merely government conjecture.
Okay, fair enough, Leonard. So let me just go back to your early days. I mean, as people who are allegedly involved in illicit drug production and distribution are involved, yours is a really kind of specialized area in that you were a chemist, by many accounts, a brilliant chemist, and became, involved in this, in making LSD, a drug which is... it's not cocaine. It's not heroin or methamphetamine. I mean, it sort of is in a different category in a way. And I just wanted to ask you, if you go back to your early years, I mean, you grew up in a family, I'm not sure which city it was, but with a father who was a lawyer and a mother working for the U.S. Center for Disease Control. You got a scholarship to Princeton. But at some point in your late teens, early 20s, you must have got an interest both in chemistry and in psychedelic substances.
Well, yes, I can speak to that a little, Ethan. My interest goes back to perhaps 1963, when the only marijuana available was that from jazz bands in New York City. The young people didn't have access. Then things slowly changed, and one began to see cannabis more widely available. At that point, I left Princeton in order to join what then was a youth revolution spanning the globe. You recall the song, If You're Going to San Francisco, Wear Flowers in Your Hair. And so I was part of that entire youth movement moving west, but also in New York City, London, Rome, throughout the world. Youth were experiencing an unusual, very specialized, very potent neurochemical, and having subjective experiences that were profound and unanticipated, often very spiritual or religious. So I was part of that early movement, yes.
So 1963, you're 18 then. Timothy Leary is kind of emerging on the scene. There's already been quite substantial LSD research. And it's not just LSD, right? There's also mescaline out there and mushrooms and things like that. But does LSD play a special role in when you're talking about this set of chemicals from right at the beginning? Or early on, was mescaline as of great interest to you as LSD?
Oh, not at all. Of course, mescaline reared its head among the artists of Paris in the 20s and 30s. Antoine Artaud, for example, all through Huxley's days. But I, of course, had no access to it. Pure mescaline is exceptionally rare. And of course, the dosage is several hundred milligrams. So that the first large-scale deployment of a specialized psychoactive such as LSD had to be simply that compound, which was potent at 100 micrograms, 10 million doses a kilogram. Mm-hmm. So it took this incredibly potent substance to be manufactured by small cadres of underground chemists to deploy 10 million doses throughout initially Northern California and across the United States. And thus began the revolution of the 60s, 66, 67, the advent of the Beatles, the shift in music. No one had ever heard songs such as I Am the Walrus. It was all Detroit bebop. So music changed, art changed. Spontaneous social gatherings occurred, thousands of people coming together peacefully with no police around, no bands, simply sharing sunlight and each other on a warm afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, LSD, right? I mean, it's created somewhat by accident by a chemist, Albert Hofmann, working for a pharmaceutical firm in Switzerland in 1943. And it's legally available until some point in the mid-60s or so. So were people largely obtaining it through legal or diverted legal sources up until that point?
Well, it was made illegal in 66. And before then, one could actually buy small quantities from some of the manufacturers in Europe, most prominent among them, Sandoz Laboratories in Basel, which is where Albert, Professor Hofmann, did his inventions. So occasionally, magic grams, as they were called, would appear in the United States. And that's 10 to 20,000 doses in 1 gram. Mm-hmm. And these were very carefully shared among Jungian psychoanalysts and saxophone players and abstract impressionists and theologians and quite a wide spectrum of humanity initially.
Well, there was a particularly fascinating character, I think, back in the late 50s, early 60s, named Al Hubbard, right? A businessman who got his hand on some thousands or tens of thousands of doses and supposedly made it his mission in life to go around dosing prominent individuals, 5,000 or 6,000 people, business leaders, famous actors, intellectuals. Did you ever cross paths with him in those days, or did you have any special insights into this pioneering sort of Johnny Appleseed of LSD?
I'm aware of Hubbard, but I did not cross paths with him. He was quite a remarkable character and would often wear a Boy Scout suit and carry a faux handgun, sort of quasi-militaristic spoof on, you know, oppressive control regimes. He was a trickster, had a great deal of fun. But I did become well acquainted with a very beloved psychiatrist named John Beresford, who passed away about 2015. John is famous for bringing in the magic gram into the United States and turning on, or rather exposing, if you will, to the subjective effects of LSD, a stunning array of scientists and physicians and seekers of every kind.
Uh-huh. Well, you and I also had a friend in common, Alexander, a.k.a. Sasha Shulgin, who, you know, some would describe as one of the most brilliant chemists ever to devise psychedelic-oriented substances in his backyard lab, where both you and I were visitors in Lafayette, California, back when he was still alive. Now, he's most known for discovering or rediscovering MDMA, aka ecstasy, and its properties, but also inventing 2CB and writing some remarkable books with his wife, Ann Shulgin, about this. When do you meet Sasha Shulgin, and how does he land up becoming, I guess, something of a mentor in your life?
Oh, my goodness. Sasha is a truly beloved figure, and frankly, I loved him. I first became of his work at 21. I'm standing in Mallinckrodt, the old Mallinckrodt Laboratories at Harvard, and looking through a bound volume of the Journal of Organic Chemistry and looking at a set of compounds called phenethylamines, which were psychoactive. And there was this most unusual paper describing the production of phenethylamines, written by an author whose affiliation was not Dow Chemical or this or that university, but simply 1483 Shulgin Road, Lafayette, California. I went, Mike, what is this? And it described the first human effects. It was unusual that a prestigious journal such as Organic Chemistry would publish human work, but Sasha did it. That was, 66 or so. And I followed every paper that Sasha wrote with his co-worker, Peyton Jacobs III, for 20 years. But, of course, never met the man. I was too awed by his capability and stature. And at that point, I was at Stanford and had a problem involving the synthesis of mescaline that was intractable. I was looking at this particular process, and there was just no way around a particular synthetic hurdle. And I thought Sasha would be the only person to whom one might dare approach and ask about this. So I braved writing a letter to 1483 Shulgin Road in Lafayette, and rather quickly came back an invitation, personal invitation signed by Sasha, to visit his class at that time in toxicology at San Francisco State, although he also taught at Berkeley. Thus I appeared, and there was Sasha, 6'5" of extraordinarily white, thick mane of hair, with the devoted Anne always in attendance, and their daughter Wendy with her mane of golden hair. And there was Sasha in front of the class, with a great smile, scribbling these exotic structures on the chalkboard of most elegant molecules. And he had a certain glee about him, as though he was respectful of these creations that he had made and understood how they reached rather deeply into people's hearts and minds, and somehow conveyed that to all of us. I can recall going through that entire semester with a smile.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I just want to say to our listeners, it's important for me, when I mention the name of Sasha Shulgin in this conversation with Leonard, or as I have in conversations with other guests, it's because I do think it's important to appreciate who some of the founders in drug research and drug policy were. And Sasha Shulgin really was this sort of godfather of psychedelics research. And in some respects, his wife, Anne, was the godmother because she was his co-writer on so much of what he did. I'm just trying to get a sense of your life then, right? So you're born in 45, 63, you're 18, you spend a little time at Princeton, you start hanging out in Greenwich Village, the jazz scene, the marijuana scene, you head out west, San Francisco, and everything's opening up there. There's all this leaning psychedelics figures, there's Ken Kesey. And so in that period, in your 20s, you know, you don't end up getting arrested for anything until you're in your 30s or 40s or something like that. Are you basically just hanging out? Are you a research assistant? Are you working for pharmaceutical firms? Are you, to the extent you can say, engaged in beginning to produce some of these things, either legally as part of projects or not so legally? What can you tell us about your 20s in the West Coast and wherever else?
Well, you're very kind to ask me, Ethan, you know, but I can't say that I'm part of a secret society or that anyone else was. But I think if one were part of a secret society, and in those days one sort of had to be to avoid being persecuted, then it would be most honorable to maintain that secrecy, even when there was no longer any need for it. I lived in the mountains, the far mountains, the great forest, the snowfields. I lived in the far deserts. You could hear the coyotes bark and the full moon upon the desert. I lived near the oceans with the ceaseless waves. And I studied. I haunted the libraries of Berkeley and Stanford and San Francisco State, San Jose State, as much academia as I could gather, looking at structures of molecules, studying what today is psychedelic space, but in those years was almost a forbidden topic. One did not mention these drugs at the risk of one's career, as you well recall. So I became well-studied in all aspects of the chemistry and pharmacology of these compounds, and of course, naturally, broader aspects of pharmacology, pharmacokinetics, toxicology. I gathered several hundred undergraduate credits from multiple institutions. And in between these forays into reading and thought and practice, I lived in most remote areas imaginable.
I see. So even in talking about what you personally were doing, independent of what other people in the, what's the phrase, the Brotherhood of Underground Chemists were engaged in. So I can understand that and defer to your need to be cautious about that. Let me take the conversation this way. What would have been involved in setting up an LSD lab? You know, what are the risks, the challenges? What's surprisingly easy? What's surprisingly difficult?
Well, that's, of course, a very deep question. You're asking me about what is required to establish a clandestine laboratory. And, of course, I can only speak to that, given my present situation, by projecting it upon third parties, people that I have interviewed, underground chemists that I have interviewed, and I cannot, of course, speak to it personally. But I can address the topic given those caveats. To establish an underground laboratory, and I wouldn't do this at home, kids, requires, first of all, the rather dedicated faith of a small group of people who have, in effect, given their lives over to this particular art. Because even through the present day, with billion-dollar corporations proliferating, we must recall that all these materials are still Schedule I. No known medical use with the most severe penalties. For an underground laboratory, easily a mandatory life without possibility of parole. So I certainly will not suggest anyone entertain the prospect of doing so. However, those that braved this assembly first collected a small handful of the faithful and experienced that had spent their entire lives in the field, and then accumulating the appropriate glassware and technical instruments, which could be quite extensive and would fill a room, four walls of a 120-square-foot room to the ceiling, or several rooms, appropriate liquids, reagents, exotic specialized glassware, some of it handmade by pharmaceutical glass firms, a very elegant and sensitive process. Not difficult, more difficult than methamphetamine. But the difficulty arises not so much in the conversion of, say, lysergic acid to LSD, but in scaling up from a few milligrams to hundreds of grams or kilograms, a world quantity, if you will, 10 million doses, 20 million doses. That requires highly specialized equipment and practices. And some of those practices are not simply technical. One may find oneself in a moon suit with protective face shields and respirators and gloves made of material which won't permit dissolution by any solvent. One may find oneself in this regalia 100 miles from the nearest paved road with pumps whirring and at 3 a.m. bathed in red light to prevent any breaking of the molecule by normal light. Syntheses conducted under noble gases such as argon, surrounded by things which remind the manufacturer of the responsibility that the manufacturer has for the effect of this substance in potentially millions of minds. And that is not something that's simply a 9-to-5 job and one forgets about and goes home. That's a responsibility which consumes every moment of one's day, weeks, months, years, one's life. Within the setting, there may be votives, depending upon one's religious tradition, candles, incense, fires burning, music playing, ranging from Gregorian chant to Hildegard von Bingen to Peruvian music, to chants by Maria Sabina, the Mazatec curandera in Oaxaca. And within this great assembly of light and sound and music, a number of the principal chemist in the past, Owsley, Nick Sand of the Brotherhood, Tim Scully, who is still with us, would at the moment of conversion from lysergic acid to LSD, the moment when suddenly 10 million hits becomes psychoactive, that very 5 minutes, they inevitably, and Nick mentioned this publicly, they inevitably would pray in their own tradition. Nick would pray standing, others would kneel, place their hand upon the reaction kettle, and ask that this substance be a true medicine in the hearts and minds of those that used it. It would be a medicine to heal, to alleviate suffering throughout the world, to act as a kind of grace upon us.
You know, Leonard, when I hear you describe this, part of what it sounds like is almost a hybrid of, on the one hand, I love the series Breaking Bad, right, about the methamphetamine manufacturer and who does the highest quality methamphetamine and who has this great underground lab in the end and all of this stuff. And they have to wear suits in the way that you describe and a high level of meticulousness and pride in their expertise. Yet on the other hand, there's this element in what you describe that resembles the preparation of psychedelic and psychoactive substances by shamans in traditional society. Would it be fair? Is that an accurate thing to describe as, in some sense, that hybrid?
Well, I have to challenge the comparison with Breaking Bad. You know, methamphetamine is a malaise upon humanity. I've lost count of the number of individuals I've seen come into federal holding facilities emaciated and picking at their skin from weeks and months of intravenous methamphetamine. So it carries a kind of, if you will, evil karma.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I think there's also the difference between methamphetamine that's being used in a medicinal frame and these others. But I take your point about that. Leaving aside what you regard as the immorality, and that many people regard as the immorality of producing methamphetamine for the illicit market, is it fair to say that there's some element of a hybrid between those two things, the modern-day lab and the spiritual tradition of the, you know, indigenous healers who are producing these substances?
Absolutely. I'm sure Walter White never prayed that his product act as a grace upon the users. At the same time, there is a shamanic aspect, I suppose. Underground chemists, of course, recognize a great responsibility that the material be pure and used appropriately and conveyed appropriately. I think that that may be best summed up in a statement that I think Tim Scully, who is Nick Sands' partner, made not long ago and is agreed upon by a number of underground manufacturers, that the effect of the substance may reflect in some small way the intent of the chemist. What the chemist has in their heart may reflect in the heart of the user. And so it's imperative that one ascribe to a certain purity and a certain compassion.
We'll be talking more after we hear this ad.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep Tight Stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights' sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
The names you mentioned before, I mean, Owsley, there are books now written about him, and I think people sometimes refer to a Owsley LSD that they found in a drawer somewhere, you know, his particular qualities. I think I remember watching a documentary about Nick Sands of late. I hadn't known about Tim Scully till I was researching for doing this episode with you, and I don't know how accurate these books and documentaries are. Could you just give us a little more of a sketch about each of the three of them, what was special about each one of them and that broader brotherhood of which they were a part?
Yes, I can speak a little bit to each. Owsley, fondly known as Bear in the Grateful Dead touring community, hence the Dancing Bears on Grateful Dead logos, was responsible for the first major distribution or drop of LSD in the 60s. Perhaps 1 million doses distributed as double dome white lightnings or press tablets with Batman on it. The first 1 million doses, he made about 500 grams over his life, 1 million doses, as he self-reported. Bear was also created the wall of sound for the Grateful Dead shows and their enormous number of subterranean tapes, which have just surfaced of Bear's recordings of early Dead. He died in Australia about 2015. Nick Sand, quite a flamboyant and wonderful individual, was the subject of a recent film, The Sunshine Makers, strongly recommended to get a feeling for Nick. Nick and Tim were arrested for making about 10 million doses. I attended the trial, I think in 73, and listened to Tim testify in the shortly thereafter, Tim went to prison for 2 years, and Nicky absconded to Pune, India, where he continued his manufacturing and became quite a underground figure. Extraordinary individual and very much outspoken and out front and would not limit his views on matters. Nicky, truly seminal figure. And they did 2 kilograms, about 10 million doses. Nicky, over his lifetime, produced 13 kilograms, about 130 million doses.
Is there anyone else we left out?
Well, those are the primary figures. There are a number of individuals who manufactured a kilo or two. Mm-hmm. Todd Svensson in Boston, those that I won't name because they were never arrested. Mm-hmm. The world of clandestine LSD manufacture is small, mm-hmm. perhaps a handful of individuals, 5 or 10 individuals worldwide. It's been that way for 50 years, generally centered in San Francisco, but labs can just as easily be in Belgium or Italy.
But if there were key people in Europe, they never got arrested.
There have been quite a number of people who have never been arrested. One of the more interesting figures just passed away. That would be Dennis Kelly, who did 2 years for a very large lab. Production was called Clearlight. This was in the mid-70s. They were producing in Burnt Ridge, Oregon, a form of LSD known as windowpane, because they were little squares of translucent gelatin, a very famous batch. Dennis, again, produced about 2 to 3 kilograms. But after his 2 years of incarceration, Dennis entered the Zen, Soto Zen community, and became a Zen priest. And for the next 50 years, was known as Kenpo, and developed quite a following. He has a beautiful monastery. Dai Bosatsu Monastery in Mount Tremper, New York, is Dennis's creation. He just passed away a few months ago and left an autobiography maybe of interest to your listeners.
Uh-huh. And Leonard, the Buddhist Zen tradition was something that you embraced periodically or maybe throughout your life, huh?
Well, as a young person, I looked fondly down at Tassajara and the Tassajara Bread Book, which was all the rage during the hippie years, but something sort of called to me about them, but I couldn't quite bring myself to stop what I was doing and go don robes and face the wall for weeks. That seemed rather esoteric. But after my first release from 5 years in prison, where I was exposed to a Chinese priest that came in from the Chinese monastery in L.A., I went directly to Soto Zen, the oldest Soto Zen monastery in North America, and knocked on the door and asked admission and was taken in and remained there for 2 years. A very rigorous practice, up at 3 a.m, morning sittings at 4 a.m, sweeping the sidewalks at 5 a.m, robed. Lots of chanting and very formal, refined practices in the Japanese tradition. Very beautiful and gentle. People would bow to you in the hallway, which was quite a change of pace from stabbings in prison. So I became quite fond of the monastic setting and left only when I received a letter of acceptance from Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, simply had to go.
So, Leonard, now that one, I'll say, has a lab set up to produce at large volume, how long does it take to produce how big a batch? And is this something that you would do for some weeks at a time and then just take off a long time? Or was this an ongoing process that could go on for months and months and months?
Well, the government's primary witness stated that the lab he alleged I was responsible for produced about a kilogram a month for 20 years. That would be 250 kilograms. But of course, that to me is quite fanciful. We'll let the listener decide on that. In terms of the process itself, the process would depend upon at what stage in history that you're simply doing the synthesis. Nikki and Tim were young men, late 20s, early 30s, they were using an antique cookbook method called Garbrick, which is quite toxic, involving sulfur dioxide, patented process. I'm not quite sure the process Owsley used, but probably something quite similar to it, or another patented public process, which is relatively low yield or produces a number of byproducts. But as the science evolved over the next 30 and 40 years. By the time we get to 2000, processes existed, if one were a devotee of the literature and really thought about these things, processes existed which would produce in a non-flammable way, at room temperature, large quantities of immensely pure LSD. These were never published in the sense that it might destabilize the world market or make entry into manufacture too simple. People thought it was probably best that there be some scientific hurdle that would prevent those that were less dedicated from entering the field, so that simple cookbook methods for these very advanced, high-yield methods were never published.
I see. Was anybody you know of ever harmed in the process of producing LSD?
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm. What you're describing, you know, suggests, I mean, it's like when I was, you know, thinking about your ostensibly getting into this line of work, and what would motivate you. You wonder how the combination of, on the one hand, just the challenge of it all, the natural aptitude and curiosity about chemistry, the appreciation for LSD and some of these other psychedelic substances having special properties for humankind. But there was also the element that, you know, all of the people, or I don't know all, but most were allegedly selling these things and earning sometimes some fairly substantial amounts of money. But many of the key players were also apparently using their money in sometimes more in philanthropic ways, as opposed to buying fancy houses or boats or, you know, having, you know, this sort of lifestyle. So I'm curious, how is it that mixture of variables in all of this? Is it one factor that stands out more than others? You know, I realize you can't fully reflect on your own perspectives on this, but speaking a little more in the abstract or among members of the Brotherhood of Underground Chemists?
Well, I can go back to, I think, what Nick said before his death, that he felt it was a calling that one is called upon, if you will, in Nick's case by some higher power, to do this sort of thing. Of course, one easily sacrifices one's life, at least in the past, not so much in the future. I mean, we're going to see corporations manufacturing LSD as they are now with government licensing. And that brings up an interesting point, which goes back to your early question about shamanic manufacture. In the future, the illicit medicalization and use of psychedelics, the sources will not be by someone who searches their soul and prays over a pure compound. It will be done by a technician, perhaps in China, who simply goes home at 5 o'clock. And the question is, will this affect the outcome in the hearts and minds of the users?
Well, I mean, one could engage in controlled double-blind studies on this down the road, right? Well, or people could do their own at-home controlled blind study and, you know, randomly see and see, you know, record those experiences. But what do you think?
Of course, we're speculating here, Ethan. You know, scientifically, the idea of an individual influencing the outcome of a drug in a third party is not tenable. Mm-hmm. It's merely myth. But it's an entertaining myth, and it may keep certain manufacturers on their toes if they think they have to harbor a pure heart.
You know, it relates to another issue there, right? I mean, there's a conversation that I've had, I think, in some of the other interviews, but about the difference between the synthesized chemical, the mescaline on the one hand, and the peyote or San Pedro from which, you know, it can be derived, or with psilocybin and mushrooms. And there are those, I think Sasha Shulgin would be included, who said, you know, whether it's a synthetically produced or whether it's coming from something that's growing in nature, you know, it's still basically the same chemical. And if anything, the basic chemical may even be a little easier because it doesn't come with the things that upset your stomach and things like that that happen with a plant product. And others who believe that there's something either fundamentally different or better about having it come from the plant itself. And now you're saying that even when you produce something synthetically, that having a Nick Sands or an Owsley produce this is somehow going to produce a different product than would be some, you know, employee of a pharmaceutical company a decade from now who's just doing this stuff as part of his 9-to-5 job. And so what about that first point between the natural plant-based substance and the synthetic?
I would tend to agree with Sasha that synthesized mescaline, hemisulfate dihydrate, for example, the most beautiful long needles, these are 10 centimeter needles, the most beautiful physical substance imaginable. If that mescaline is the same as the mescaline of an all-night Native American church ceremony with prayer fans and incense around the fire and the teepee and the dawn woman bringing water and all the prayers and chants for healing, are those two different? Well, the mescaline isn't. The circumstances in which it is offered are quite different. So I think that myths, if you will, or positive set and setting is a strong factor with the natural substances. Of course, there are many new startups. I see them in pitch decks every week of firms that are attempting to make various elixirs from psilocybin mushrooms, claiming that the other materials, psychoactive and non-psychoactive, in the mushroom itself will influence the subjective effect and the healing properties. And other larger concerns say, no, pure psilocybin speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. So these have yet to be resolved. I suspect the industry will resolve these conundrums in the next few years, and we'll all have great fun watching it happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I want to come back to this toward the end of the interview, because part of our connecting or reconnecting in recent months is around some of this new world of the investment in the psychedelics for profit. But let me just correct me if I'm wrong on this. But so when you, the sense I have from what you're saying is of a calling, of seeing that this is something called to do, and that a persistence of doing this even in the face of obstacles. And so I came across, and tell me if this is factually correct or not, but when I, one of the pieces I found said, well, you know, Leonard, your first arrest in this area was a petty arrest, what, in 1976 for possession of peyote. And then there's something else about another, I think, I don't know how minor, but for creating a small MDMA lab back in the mid-70s. And then some years later, in the late 80s, you get arrested in Mountain View, California for allegedly having an LSD lab, spent 5 years in prison until 92, come out, and a number of years where you're engaging with academia, getting a master's degree at the Kennedy School, writing in publications. But then the big bust on, I think it was Election Day 2000, which put you in prison for 20 years. Now, if those details are correct, it suggests that you were, how could I say, incorrigible in the most upstanding sort of way, since fundamentally I do believe that the work that you were allegedly engaged in performed an enormous community service for humankind throughout this period. But I mean, it does suggest that these criminal justice penalties kept coming after you, but that you kept persisting with something that you loved to do.
Well, yes, Ethan, you've kind of got me on the spot there. But yes, so there were multiple arrests involving psychedelic drugs, perhaps every 7 or 8 years, one would occur. And these range from a minor arrest where one was taken away for a day or two and released because the substance wasn't what they claimed it to be or might have been legal, to arrests which required 6 months in jail. And then the 1988 Mountain View seizure, which resulted in 5 years, which is quite a significant LSD laboratory, actually, from what I understand, the same size as the later Kansas arrest in 2000, which resulted in not 20 years, but two life sentences, mandatory life sentences, without possibility of parole. In other words, a death sentence. The possibility of sorting it all out by appellate filings is something of an American dream. And indeed does occur and supports the mercy and wisdom of our judicial system, but is so very rarely seen that men tend to lose hope. Although, at this late date, I harbor no ill will against the government.
Mm-hmm. You know, Leonard, I mean, I was about to get to this point about your sentencing, and I was looking up some of the data on this, and there's something like 2.2, 2.3 million people behind bars in America today, of whom about two-thirds are in state prisons and federal jails. Of that 1.5 million who are in state and federal prisons, roughly 200,000, the last that I saw count, are there serving a life sentence, either a mandated one or an effectively a life sentence. Half of them are Black, but interestingly, about 8%, 17,000, are people who were convicted of nonviolent offenses. Now, one can make too much of the distinction between nonviolent and violent offenses. There are people who committed, you know, nonviolent offenses. You look at what Madoff did and the fact that he died behind bars, I have no ethical problem with. And on the other hand, there are violent offenses, you know, that don't seem to me to be in some separate category from some of the horrors of what people can do nonviolently to one another. But that said, you know, and having been involved in building an organization, a movement opposing these draconian sentences for drug offenses, I mean, the first thing I want to ask you is, when I read about the judge who sentenced to you to the two life sentences with no possibility of parole, you can in your heart forgive that person? And I imagine that he's no longer alive. And part of what I read was he was a highly right-wing and maybe somewhat senile figure. But you really are able to forgive him? Because that was a discretionary choice he made, right? The law did not require him to sentence you in the way he did.
That would be Judge Richard Rogers, a very dignified Ford appointee, Republican, former mayor of Manhattan, Kansas, ardent softball player. well-loved in the legal community in Topeka, a very distinguished jurist who handed down a number of difficult but well-respected decisions. Of course, I battled in Judge Rogers' court. I wrote up over 1,000 motions, studied the law for years to write such briefs, which very thoughtfully refined by the law offices of Billy Rourke in the Topeka, a rugby-playing wild man, the last of the fighting liberal attorneys in Kansas, the late Billy Rourke. Judge Rogers occasionally entertained the jury during the longest trial in Kansas history. One of his great quotes I recall is, "This trial is like something out of the Arabian Nights," which got a great laugh from the jury. And he once called me a young man, which I really appreciated at 55. But he was most courteous. I harbor no ill will against Judge Rogers.
Even though another judge might have sentenced you to a dramatically shorter amount of time.
No, I think not. I think that Judge Rogers' hands were tied simply by the mandatory nature of sentencing. 10 grams or more of a substance containing a detectable amount of LSD, which might be 1 microgram, is mandatory life at the quantities that we're discussing. So Judge Rogers, as he mentioned at sentencing, his hands were tied.
I see. Okay, well, I stand corrected on that. I thought there was a discretionary element of it. You know, in hearing you talk in the past a little bit about your prison experience, just by chance, I've been watching this TV series called Rectify, produced by Sundance, now on AMC Plus, I think. And it's about, you know, a young man, white, who is convicted of having killed a young woman while under the influence of mushrooms, it so happens, and can't accurately recollect what happened, and then gets out 20 years later, having been traumatized by his experience and uncertain about what's going to happen in the future. And I have to say, as I was looking forward to having this interview with you and I'm watching at night this show, I started thinking about some of these parallels and just the experience, you know, of being in this place, where, you know, this an all-male environment where physical touch is either something that's either not good, or that just doesn't happen, with the sound of chains and the solitude, the fact of being in a maximum security setting when that's not called for in a case like yours or many others to protect other inmates or what have you. It seems purely punitive. But I'm curious, I mean, to get through that, and I imagine, you know, there must have been substantial periods of time where you thought that there was little to no chance of your ever becoming a free man during the rest of your life. Were there periods of profound hopelessness in all of this? And how did you sustain yourself through all of that?
Yes, that period of hopelessness, Ethan, you're entirely correct, began on November 6, 2000, and ended on July 27th, 2020. And every day in between those two dates, 20 years, I thought I would most certainly die in prison, and everyone I knew thought the same. My attorneys, my friends, my family, my children, those of the public that paid attention to the case. There is no way out from a mandatory life sentence. Simply does not occur, vanishingly rare. Only with the passage, and a miracle in itself, the passage in 2018 of the First Step Act by Congress during its last few days of session in December. The last few days, it was a bipartisan passage of the First Step Act, which, for the first time, allowed inmates to petition the court for release based on their good works or their redemption or other factors, medical, familial, that would persuade the court that they had served an adequate amount of time and were no longer a threat to the public. Naturally, I filed immediately on that very lengthy briefs, 500 pages, including exhibits, and that matriculated through the system for over a year. Denied at the institutional level by the warden, denied at the regional level by BOP, denied at the national level by the BOP director, denied by the United States Attorney's Office. So what hope was there left? And then a great miracle happened, and there was a merciful and distinguished jurist who, with great courage and wisdom, and I suppose a small amount of faith, read our petition, and in the tempo of the times was so moved as to grant release. And since then, it's been like being born again.
Yeah, but I noticed, Leonard, that when I read the decision, and it seems like he went out of his way to say, I'm doing this because of COVID. And Leonard's 75 or almost 75, and there's a risk here. But in terms of the other arguments, he didn't seem to be moved by the petition that of people who were fighting for your release or the good works you'd done in other areas or the insights you'd provided on the fentanyl crisis to people in law enforcement. Now, maybe he was just covering his butt, and maybe he was, in fact, moved by those other variables and just using the COVID as the kind of clear reason. But what do you think?
Well, I can't speak of what was in the mind of this particular jurist, except that I honor his wisdom and decision. And whatever factors influence that decision, and there could only be multiple factors, I am deeply grateful for that moment of grace.
Mm-hmm. There was somebody else in there with you, I think, a young man named Ross Ulbricht. Right, who became famous or infamous, as one might have it, because he was the founder of Silk Road, which was a decade or so ago supposedly the world's biggest dark net site for illicit activities, including obtaining illicit drugs around the world. And people were horrified when he was sentenced for life. Now, there were some accusations he may have put contracts out on some people, but those were never substantiated. His mother actually came to one of the Drug Policy Alliance biennial events, and I met her, and she's had a campaign to try to get him out. But do you see him as somebody sort of similarly situated with yourself, a kind of younger generation version of yourself who is unjustly incarcerated for far, far more time than he ever should have been?
And thank you, Ethan, for mentioning Ross. Of course, I know his mother, Lynn, his father, Kurt, and call them each night during trial in Manhattan in the very darkest days. And then as he entered the system, suggested that perhaps he should be moved to a institution that would be less gang-riddled and threatening, because Ross was, of course, a target, people assuming he had hidden Bitcoin. And he's, of course, would be a gang victim. And I recall how happy I was one day on the yard, walking in circles for 20 years on a dirt track, to see a young, then-bearded man walk in, and there he was. And we became great friends, and spoke daily, and walked quite a lot in my last year of incarceration. So I learned of Ross's heart and fears. Of course, the idea that he would harm anyone is just nonsense. Of course, even Homeland Security knew that was nonsense and didn't bring charges. A very fine-looking young man, about 33, gentle, meditative, a deep reader in economics, a writer, a sensitive young man that has been in for 8 years now, surely has gotten the message. And would never, never reoffend, and would be a tremendous asset in the crypto world, in the Bitcoin world, as a speaker, as a teacher. Lynn, his mother, told me that when Ross heard of my release, he cried, not out of self-pity, but out of happiness, because we'd talk, we knew every detail of each other's cases and hopes and fears and every filing and everything about each other's families. And so we shared the fear and the dwindling hope, and the simple faith of a mustard seed, if you will, in biblical terms, that it all might change.
Mm-hmm.
And when it did for me, I guess the reservoirs and Ross broke loose. I promised him that when I spoke in podcast or spoke publicly, I would always mention him and draw public attention to his plight. It's time for him to go home. The most heartbreaking thing to me with Ross on the rare occasions I had visits was that Ross always had visits, every visiting period, from a lovely French programmer, a woman that fell in love with Ross while he was away. They had special permission to see each other a lot. So I'd be in the visiting room and she would come in. They would have a brief hello and goodbye, just a brief hug, and spend hours talking. And I would sit there and think to myself how beautiful, but also how very, very sad because these young people are still in the honeymoon phase. He'd only been in 8 years. And so they still had faith that something might miraculously change by a motion, a habeas motion, a 2255, some elegant legal argument. And they don't know the dark, lonely years that stretch endlessly ahead. Ross could be there 20 years. He could be there 30 years. I've said goodbye to more than one inmate who has done 40 years. So my heart would break watching them. It is important that the public that cares about evolution of computers, evolution of psychedelics, evolution of simple humanity and freedom for the individual, recognize that long-term imprisonment of the nonviolent will be seen as uncivilized.
Yeah.
And 8 or 9, 10 years is enough for anyone for a nonviolent crime.
No, Leonard, I mean, of course I agree with you. And I think it's, you know, it's part of the dark side of America's exceptionalism, that not only have we broken all records in the history of human civilization in terms of the percent of the population we're incarcerating, but also the way in which we throw away so many hundreds of thousands of people's lives, you know, for life, and these incredible amounts of time. You know, I had heard you elsewhere talking about how you got through, you know, these decades thinking this might be all it would ever be. And obviously you were writing your legal briefs and those were time consuming. And I read about how you talked about becoming a big fan of 19th century British literature and reading vastly in that way. And you had relationships with people like Ross and others. I mean, there was that. But then I think one other thing you did was you wrote a book. And in reading about the book, it made me think of the book that Sasha Shulgin and his wife Anne wrote. They wrote a book called PIHKAL, P-I-H-K-A-L, which stood for phenethylenes I have known and loved. And the second half of the book is basically the recipes for all these psychedelic substances. But the first half is a sort of thinly disguised autobiographical account of their lives. And they felt a need to frame it as fiction because of the consequences of the law. And you wrote a book which I think integrated some autobiographical with some fictional elements as well. Maybe you could just tell our listeners a bit about that.
Thank you, Ethan. The book is called The Rose of Paracelsus. Paracelsus was a 16th century alchemist in Basel, philosopher. And the title is adapted from a short story by the Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges. I wrote this almost 700-page tome in pencil, since there were only 10 rickety typewriters for 1,800 men, and they were only available a few hours a day. But it was also very nourishing to write by hand. I spent 20 years reading mostly Victorian Edwardian literature. I found that a great respite. When I looked up, there were, you know, bloody gang battles and stabbings and killings and loudspeakers going off and tons of razor wire and guard towers and flashbang grenades and tattooed faces with spider webs. And when I looked down into the text, I might be in 19th century England with carriages and horses and manors and a gentler world. So it was easy to choose between the two. So the Rose of Paracelsus is written in a very mannered, almost Victorian, almost archaic language that will be familiar to those that are devoted readers of literature, but maybe very difficult for those that expect a casual, breezy read. The wordcraft is dense. There are puzzles and foreshadowings. And a little humor, not all ponderous. But in writing it, sitting in a 60-square-foot steel cell forever, I found myself trying to remember what the world looked like, because after about 5 years, you forget images. You still see your family's face, your children's face, of course, but you haven't seen a flower or a dog or a cat or a river or a forest or a tree in so many years that these are majestic recollections, but they are evaporating quickly, and so one tries to hold on to them. So in writing The Rose, I tried to describe, for example, a great forest, and had some difficulty in doing that.
Let's take a break here and go to an ad.
Parents,
If you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024. And we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Leonard, you know, we really just met a few months ago, and so I really know the Leonard post this experience in prison. But I'm curious, when you reflect, or when people who have known you for a very long time re-encounter you now, what are your and their perceptions about how you have changed or evolved as a human being, as a personality, from your days before you went into that life sentence?
Oh, I can't see myself, Ethan. I don't know. I would put it as the younger version was probably brash and excited and perhaps overconfident. The current version, which is 20 years on, is an elderly man with quite a few wrinkles, but I still manage to twinkle and have some laughs and a growing, wonderful circle of friends and my family is reawakening. However joyous the times were just before my arrest, as you can possibly imagine the complexity and ecstasies of those days, the simple joys now are transcendent. I've never had more fun in my life than, frankly, the last few months.
I have to say, I was amazed when we met in New York a few months ago, and then when you were in Boulder. We were both in Boulder for a meeting involving also the psychedelics investment area. And then I think you were visiting your son, who is in medical school there. But I was just blown away at the way here you are. When you went away 20 years ago, technology was so radically different. And here you are connecting with whole new worlds of people, getting deeply engaged in the whole new, you know, breakout research with psychedelics and the investment side of that. You're introducing me to people I didn't know in this field, which was really quite special for me. And I was just struck by, you know, how well, I mean, maybe it's just a kind of quasi facade and you go back at home at night and collapse in some pile because of what you've been through. But it's quite extraordinary to see you. I mean, here we are in crazy Manhattan a few months ago and you seem perfectly fine. I wonder if that many people could come out of your experience of 20 years of incarceration in a maximum security federal correctional institution, most of which spent hopelessly thinking you will never get out, and come out with that level of vitality and youthfulness and high spirit and renewed curiosity about all around you. I mean, what you're saying here, it does seem like you're having the time of your life, that this is this, you know, monumental gift that has been presented to you to make the most of.
You're absolutely right, Ethan. It was like, frankly, it's with a circle of friends and startups and investors and just the expanding social nature of the world, which is increasingly intensifying, especially the psychedelic revolution that's now occurring. It feels like coming home. I feel warmly received wherever I go. It's like a party where everyone knows each other and it's all okay. And one's words are received well and one's thoughts are respected, and there's mutual respect ricocheting about. It's a new world. You know, it wasn't so long ago, Ethan, that if you mention the word psychedelic, you risk your career, and certainly in academia. And now, it's a worldwide conversation of, we hope, great promise for new medicines. And this may or may not occur. That's an entirely another conversation, but things look very promising. So it's a type of reaffirmation and redemption, and helps forget all the suffering.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let me ask you about this new focus of your life, because, I mean, look, quite frankly, it almost entirely because of you, it's possible that I may soon become an advisor for the first time in my life to a for-profit investment fund that's investing in a host of psychedelic enterprises. And so I think you and I probably share the kind of both worries and hopes of this. I mean, not just the incredible work that's been sponsored by MAPS, you know, Rick Doblin's Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, with all some wonderful work on MDMA and public education and all of that, and the Hefter Society, the group of academics who have been involved in this research for a few decades or more now. But now with the whole growth of the commercialized for-profit side, which seems to hold the potential to provide the hundreds of millions of dollars in funding that could not be raised philanthropically and therefore is expediting this whole evolution. And yet, on the other hand, it involves commercialization. And as you said, the risk that this will be taken in the wrong direction by companies that are seeking to maximize profit by, you know, securing patents and excluding others, or by manufacturers who don't really care about the special properties of what they're producing, but only the market potential. You know, what's going on now from your perspective? I mean, is this really a bubble that's going to burst and there'll just be a small number of players left? Is the reason why the psilocybin thing is looming so large now in MDMA, but are we going to see more stuff with mescaline and LSD down the road? Do you think it really will replace, you know, the SSRIs or other, you know, substances, you know, pharmaceuticals that are taken daily by large numbers of people and make, you know, pharmaceutical companies vast profits, but with, you know, only modest efficacy? So I just run three different sorts of questions about the future, but take a swing at any one of those you care to.
Oh, my goodness. That's quite a breadth of questions. Let me go back to say how much I admire the work of Rick Doblin with MAPS. I was privileged to be at Rick's PhD thesis defense at the Kennedy School back in, 96. And have come to admire the great work done by MAPS and by the Hefter Foundation. Dr. David Nichols, the foremost medicinal chemist in the world, was an early founder. Tremendous early and visionary work, and both those organizations were formed in days where the specter of psychedelic drugs being used for healings was marginalized, if not ridiculed. So it took quite a bit of courage of Rick and Dr. Nichols to act upon their vision, often at the possibility of the wrong direction of their careers. But now it's all come round, and here we are with over 300 corporations and counting now formed, some valued at $1 billion, Compass Pathways, Atai, Cybin, MindMed, all evolving out of effectively the 2015 publication, the Journal of Psychopharmacology, by Roland Griffiths at Hopkins, the study of psilocybin and depression, and Rick's early faith that MDMA would be useful for PTSD. And here we are. Are we in a bubble? Of course, I'm a rather elderly and devoted hippie who might proselytize. Even so, I think that we're in a time of tremendous enthusiasm, perhaps a little too much enthusiasm, in the sense that you have a core of true believers that hope that these drugs will be useful for various psychiatric illnesses. And indeed, they're powerful, and indeed they may, and the results seem very promising. But I see an enthusiasm that perhaps is too broad. These compounds are not a panacea for all known maladies, but the corporatization and the corporatization field, we see every known psychedelic being promoted, Salvin Orne, 5-methoxy-DMT, mescaline-LSD-psilocybin, psilocin, every analog, ketamine clinics are popping up worldwide. It's all happening all at once. Billions of dollars, hundreds if not thousands of chemists and psychiatrists and neuroscientists all focusing in this field. A milestone was reached the other day by Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, a truly eminent and conservative leading figurehead who said psychedelics may well be useful. So, looking carefully at a number of pitch decks each week that come across my desk and seeing the range of new founders and ideas, some are not strongly scientifically supported, others are true gems and may become major, major institutions. That all said, I do feel that we're in a classic bubble, stock-wise, and that within the next 2 or 3 years, there probably will be a shakeout, depending upon the outcomes of the initial clinical trials. MAPS will report first on MDMA, followed by MindMed, Cybin, Psilocybin. The outcomes of these trials, which are self-reported by the sponsoring corporation and must be by federal law, may define the industry. A trial that goes south will deflate valuations. A trial that is promising in phase two will enhance valuations. But keep in mind, across pharmaceuticals in their entirety, even antibiotics, only 14% of new drugs are approved by FDA. I suspect that psychedelics will receive no less scrutiny than any drug, and perhaps far more. So we'd better be right. And I think in some cases, we are right. But folks, hold on to your hat. We're in the Wild West, and the next few years is going to be quite a ride.
Yeah. Well, Leonard, you know, back in your days of freedom in the 90s, and you got your master's degree at the Kennedy School, you worked with an academic, Mark Kleiman, who was a devoted friend of yours and a bit of a frenemy of mine. But, you know, you wrote a brilliant paper about fentanyl at a time when few people knew what that was, and you correctly predicted that this could potentially become a great threat to public health. And you missed a bit by thinking that it might be Russia that would emerge as a major source rather than China. But I'm curious, bringing back to the psychedelics area, does China have a future in this psychedelics area? I mean, you see them playing this role kind of illegally on the fentanyl thing. You see them playing a role as a pioneer on some of the e-cigarette stuff, for better and worse. What about psychedelics?
How interesting you should ask that, Ethan. China, of course, has the world's largest pharmaceutical industry, 50,000 or so firms, and is rather loosely regulated, hence the rather grave influx of every known analog of fentanyl into Europe. Some are quite potent, you know, 4,000 times the potency of morphine. And China, of course, is the primary source country, although Mexico, certain Mexican labs have been devastating in terms of the lethality of their production. It's difficult to answer your question on that, Ethan. Has China awakened to psychedelics? No, it has not. I keep a spreadsheet of every known startup I can find, over 300 now, and nothing coming out of China. A few Japanese pharmaceutical firms are looking somewhat at isomers of ketamine, but China remains the sleeping giant. I feel that it would be wise of activists in this field, especially the corporate figures, to reach out to Chinese venture capital firms and attempt to engage them and excite them into this realm. I think that additional billions will flow into research if we manage to do that. China being very conservative, having no broad underground as we do in the States and Europe. There was no Brotherhood of Eternal Love in the 60s putting out tens of millions of doses. So they have no mature investors who had dazzling insights around campfires in their youth. Mm-hmm. There's no Chinese versions of our San Francisco right. young billionaires. But those of us that have Chinese connections, I'm looking at direction personally, might do well to try for a clinical trial in Shandong province or Beijing or Hong Kong and gently awaken the Chinese to this as part of the world community.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see. I think China, the Chinese government played a sort of leading role a few years ago in a very bad way in trying to ban the use of ketamine more broadly. You know, much of the world, ketamine is used for pain relief where opioids are not available. But Leonard, let me finish with one last question. So as all of these new psychedelic compounds are being created by changing a molecule here and there, and sometimes non-psychedelic compounds as well, is there anything out there on the horizon that you think shows really exceptional interest that would take matters beyond where we have with MDMA, LSD, the basics that are out there? Are there new compounds that you're aware of that could land up being approved or show great potential in one way or another?
Well, keep in mind, Ethan, with the corporatization, which has stimulated enormous advances in intensity of new medicinal chemists working feverishly at their benches with novel methods of invention and manufacture, with this huge illicit activity going on now, we are seeing historically for the first time the advent of tens of thousands, of hundreds of thousands of molecular variants. These generally in previous years, say 20 years ago, would be published in the scientific journals for everyone to see. Mm-hmm. But with the corporatization, such things are proprietary. I'm told every week, even under non-disclosure agreement, that, oh, I'm sorry, we can't share our patent application. So the work is becoming, oddly, clandestine yet again. That all said, since I can't point to any specific compound, I can say with some confidence that we will see a variety of new creatures appear. Now, most of these new creatures will be not very interesting, a psychedelic wash or a buzz, if you will, somewhat change of consciousness. Some will be, hopefully, most precious. Mm-hmm. They will resolve post-traumatic disorders. They may resolve postpartum depression, may resolve certain types of anxiety. They may replace parts of pharmacopoeia. Or they may replace certain types of SSRIs, although that's quite a reach to say that. But the fear I have is that within this great generation of new creatures, some may be rather difficult little beast and prove to be quite addictive or quite lethal. We've already seen an example of this coming out of the Free University of Berlin back about 2006. A postdoc there was tinkering with one of Sasha's variations on his remarkable drug 2CB. Which is a worldwide recreational compound now. And this fellow, a decent researcher, exploring did a series of modifications, and he came up with something called, for lack of a better chemical name, N-bomb. And N-bomb turned out to be psychedelic, very potent at about, 80 micrograms, as potent as LSD. And so this was immediately seized upon by hasty underground people and distributed as LSD. The problem was that it was quite lethal. There were a number of deaths. So my fear is that within this great search and great discovery of thousands and thousands of quite remarkable compounds, we'll see it go both ways. We may see a new drug that will sweep the world and has a positive benefit upon humanity, ranging from medical use to personal seeking, if you will. And it may replace, in large part, the legacy compounds, LSD, DMT, mescaline, psilocybin. But I think along with that, we may also see some most unfortunate things occur. Yet it's our responsibility in the psychedelic community to suppress one and promote the other.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so Leonard, when you were allegedly involved in production and certainly involved in this world and this brotherhood, what was your thinking about the broader consequences? I mean, did you basically see the use of LSD by millions or tens of millions of people as a generally positive thing, notwithstanding the risks? And then when you fast forward to today, where a lot of this is moving forward in this kind of medical, you know, research environment, even as larger and larger numbers of people are doing it outside that setting, what is your thinking and hopes vis-a-vis the whole endgame of this?
Well, that's a difficult question, Ethan. I think back to our thinking as very young people in the 60s when we were 21, 22, 23. The young people of the era had great hope that the insights provided by these compounds would alter society in benevolent ways to become less militaristic, less unaware of the environment, more aware of each other, to be delighted by the gifts of the mind. And then over the years, I saw people being lost in different things, lost in methamphetamine and heroin addiction and cocaine addiction, all those malaises that went on forever. And I saw those horrors quite close up and deaths from them. And so I often remark when so asked, is it best that everybody take LSD? I would say no. I think LSD or any psychedelic is only for a certain section of the population, maybe a minority of the population. It's for some people, but not everyone. In terms of the many analogs proliferating and the tendency of young people to try every known drug in the book, available freely online these days, I would say that we should remember that after all our explorations, we have to come home. We have to come home to the natural mind, the place where we began as young people before we had exposure to these substances or to extreme experiences. The simple, pure place that is our ultimate gift, that which we began from, and with luck and vision, will return to. So I think that after all of the explorations and all the corporatizations and all the excitement, that we simply remember to come home to the natural mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, Leonard, let's just hope that the spirit that animated you and others allegedly involved in the Brotherhood of Underground Chemists continues to infuse the field of the research in this area into the future. I want to thank you ever so much for being my guest today. It's been a pleasure to connect with you in recent months, and I look forward to our future intersections with ever greater frequency in the future. So thank you very, very, very much.
Thank you so much, Ethan. Wonderful to see you again. I look forward to many future conversations.
Psychoactive is a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. It's hosted by me, Ethan Nadelman. It's produced by Katya Kumkova and Ben Kiebrick. The executive producers are Dylan Golden, Ari Handel, Elizabeth Giesis, and Darren Aronofsky for Protozoa Pictures, Alex Williams and Matt Frederick for iHeartRadio, and me, Ethan Nadelman. Our music is by Ari Belousian. And a special thanks to Avivit Bar-Yosef, Bianca Grimshaw, and Robert Beattie. If you'd like to share your own stories, comments, or ideas, please leave us a message at 833-779-7566.
1-800-273-2460. That's 1-833-PSYCHO-0. You can also email us at psychoactive@protozoa.com or find me on Twitter at Ethan Nadelman. And if you couldn't keep track of all this, find the information in the show notes. So next week, we're going to do something different. I'll have my old friend and drug expert, Dr. Julie Holland, join me in answering questions from you, the audience.
I don't have to pee in a cup to talk to you, do I, Ethan?
Oh, well, you know, people used to say if you wanted a job at Drug Policy Alliance, you needed to fail a drug test, but that was never true. Subscribe to Psychoactive Now so you don't miss it.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes!
We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.